From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from around the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the segment's podcast. And now, your weekly roundup in news coverage. Now, if you're from Minnehaha County, you're likely familiar with the name Deb Soholt. And if not, you probably should be. She is the state senator for District 14. And if you're familiar with her work, you know she's been leading legislative efforts to evaluate and improve mental health services in South Dakota, particularly in rural areas. This week, she joined Lori to discuss the mental health legislative package lawmakers are considering during this legislative session.
Senator Soholt, thank you for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Let's talk about the mental health infrastructure in the state and some of the legislative efforts. This has been part of a multi-year legislative study. It's something you've been concerned about for a long time. And it gets right down to, what currently exists and how do we move the needle on this at all? Where do you want to begin?
It's really great that we're highlighting mental health. And one of my dreams is that we don't think about mental health as a barrier in discussion or how we work in the public. And there's no stigma around having a mental health issue because it's just another health issue. In 2018, actually, we did a summer study. I was chair of that interim work where we looked at mental health access all over in South Dakota. We were hearing a lot of cracks in the armor and people not being able to get service, inefficient ways that we were handling the transportation of people, identification services in our very remote areas. So we spent about 5 months taking a look at, and it was a huge body of work. I mean, think about it. We had to visit the Human Services Center and look at all of our inpatient and outpatient mental health offerings, as well as support structures within local communities. At the end of that year, we could see that we have about five basic areas that we really need to dig deeper. So in the legislative session of 19, we actually put forward a Senate concurrent resolution that dealt with identifying five task forces over the summer of 19 that would meet. And that was endorsed. And they're in five basic areas. We had one that was looking at acute hospitalization. How do we not move people all the way to the Human Services Center, rather embed them into acute facilities as needed within Avera Behavioral Health in Sioux Falls or in Aberdeen or Rapid City Regional. That's the four largest acute mental health centers. That was chaired by Representative Mike Dietrich. Then we had a group that was meeting, chaired by Senator Alan Solano, looking at what could we do as an alternative to hospitalization, that almost two to three day sweet spot where someone needs restabilization, they need help to link back to community-based resources. And this was really based on the work that's been spearheaded in Sioux Falls of development of a triage center for both mental health and chemical dependency issues. The third group, which was leveraging telehealth technologies anywhere that we could for access to mental health, I was the chair of that work. And then we had a work group that was looking at long-term care, because we have in statute that if you have organic brain changes that are leading to behavior changes that look like mental health issues, then you could, if you were a Medicaid patient, for instance, end up being in the Human Services Center in Yankton for the rest of your life. So we knew that we're going to have to change some regionally based long-term care issues in order to provide the right support structure to have people stay closer to home. And that was led by Representative Gene Hunhoff. And the final group was led by Representative Tim Reed out of Brookings, that had to look at community supports, particularly in long-term housing and peer-to-peer support groups. And what that work did is led to this legislative session. Out of these five task forces are eight bills, two resolutions, all acting as puzzle pieces that come together in order to support moving in that direction of providing better mental health access for citizens wherever they are in South Dakota.
Some of those bills have already seen some success and headed to the governor's desk. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, actually, they're all moving pretty well through the legislature, and they're in various stages of the process because some started as House bills, some were Senate bills. Sure. We've actually had two that have been enrolled by the governor at this juncture. I think the one that's probably still, you know, significantly up in the air, I feel pretty confident that all the rest of the bills will move forward, but is Senate Bill number 2, which has to do with state-funded 211 throughout all of the counties in South Dakota. And so right now we have a 50, last year we brought a bill forward that led to a 50-50 match in paying for 211. And so now we're going for, this would be paid 100% for the counties in the state of South Dakota. And that price tag is about $850,000 on an ongoing annual basis. You know, every year we would have to pay for that. But what's important about 211 is that in the counties that would never be able to come up with a 50% match, they are the counties that are the most vulnerable for mental health access, that we really don't have support services for them. And what we know about 211 as a de-escalation point for suicide ideation and actually, you know, going through a suicide and being able to link back to community-based resources, of doing follow-up phone calls, we just feel this is a really critical piece. You know, we can talk about mental health access, but if we really want to do something about it, that's the only bill that we have any money attached. The rest have to do with developing new business structures for mental health access. So I think this is an important bill, and we'll just see. You know, a lot of legislators feel very strongly that the state also needs to be involved in providing support, not only intellectually and emotionally, but financially.
For people in Sioux Falls who are listening and have access to 211, I think some of them would be surprised at how other places in the state don't, because it's very much, it's just integrated into, you know, when you pick up the phone in a crisis, you don't call 911, you might call 211 for a mental health emergency. Explain to people in the larger cities who have access to this, what happens in an area that doesn't have 211? What are we seeing?
Well, right now, really, the only access point they have would be to call 911. So then you end up with law enforcement and an ambulance, and sometimes in really remote areas. And we know that when people are in a mental health crisis in the home, and we also learned this from work that was done in Sioux Falls, it was an astounding statistic to me that if you can bring in the right de-escalation team that is qualified mental health providers that are skilled in de-escalating situations, 90% of those folks can stay home. They don't have to go anywhere. They don't have to go to jail. They don't have to go to the hospital.
90%.
So 90%. Yeah. Mm-hmm. In fact, we were so startled by the statistic. We heard that in 2018. We just almost didn't believe it. So part of the work that we did in my telehealth task force was the enabling legislation to be able to provide virtual mental health qualified providers coming into every first responder space. We have to develop the business structures to make that happen. But we are doing the enabling legislation to allow that to happen. So we want the counties in the most remote areas to not have to always call 911, and these are also small communities that creates quite a to-do mm-hmm. when there is a 911 call around these very personal private issues, which can be de-escalated if you bring the right people into play. So we think that 211, we've pushed a lot of pressure with Senate Bill 70 from years ago on looking at criminal justice reform and trying to support families, trying to course interrupt this recidivism in relationship to mental health, in relationship to chemical dependency. We've put a lot of downward pressure onto the counties, and we believe strongly that, you know, the state needs to be there in certain situations. Now, in a Sioux Falls that has already funded 211 because we saw it as such an important project, people say, well, then why shouldn't they continue to pay for it like they already have? And in fact, they went into the 50% match once we got that piece of legislation passed last year. Well, I believe that for all the work that Minnehaha County is doing in providing the way of these community-based structures, they will just turn that money into a new direction of providing community support for mental health, which they're already doing mm-hmm. in developing a triage center. So we'll see if we can get that 211. That where it's at now is was approved in policy. The Senate approved it in policy and in appropriations. And in the House, they approved it in the House Health and Human Services Committee as a policy idea. It's now sitting with the House Appropriations.
So we've heard a lot of reporting on industrial hemp this year and some of the discrepancies about what lawmakers feel that will cost. Do you see industrial hemp in competition with mental health and funding 211 for those for limited dollars?
Well, industrial hemp and like everything else that's on the list. And so, you know, there's two different kinds of budgets that we really look at. One is one-time money and then ongoing money. And yes, there is a lot of discussion about the ongoing dollars for hemp because I think the budget that was presented to us was with a fully mature hemp industry, we probably would need that kind of budget, which was over $3 million in law enforcement and Department of Health and testing and, you know, all these other constraints. What I had asked when that bill came forward into Senate Agriculture, which I serve on that committee, was just what is the graduated budget? Like, you know, once we determine this into law, even in 2020, we're not going to need that much money in order to move forward, not even in year two, because of people that will start to get into the hemp industry and, you know, the certification of seeds and all these other things that are going on. And when I asked the question about, you know, interstate transport, and we've had one tribe that has been certified to grow hemp within the state of South Dakota, did this budget include money that we needed for existing projects that were happening in South Dakota? And they felt that they could absorb what was happening and existing within the current budget. So we have a lot to kind of sort out. But the hemp project is no more in competition than all of the other things that are on the table. Community support providers and education and state employees. So this is where we really start to compete on the dollars.
Studying this mental health in South Dakota in the future, there's also a push to keep this conversation going. Tell me about that.
Well, we actually put together a resolution to talk about moving on to get to this regional concept so that we could develop these new regional-based centers. This is a big part of the work, and that was Senate Bill 4, of establishing regionally-based centers that would be like a 2 to 3 day length of stay, much like the triage center that's coming out of Sioux Falls. And we feel that we have done 2 years of really amazing work, that we now need to continue to build upon that, and that is HCR 6004. Now, what's interesting about that is there's other concurrent resolutions about other task forces. We're getting so many, there's no way that we are gonna be able to staff or have legislators to serve on all of those task forces that are being thought about. So there is discussion about bringing them all forward and prioritizing them for the executive board of the legislature to determine what 2 or 3 summer studies really warrant further attention. I do know that this mental health work has a lot of understanding and support from legislators. They see that we're moving forward on something that has momentum. And from each year, we've continued to build upon this idea. And the only way to actually see things to fruition, to develop a new infrastructure for mental health access, to not only provide benchmark care for our citizens, all of our citizens, which is the most important thing to me, but also to be able to provide it in an infrastructure that is the most cost effective, that keeps people closer to home, that really supports prevention and early crisis intervention versus the most expensive, most difficult level of care, which is extreme acute. And that's where we identify people right now, and we tend to move in that direction. We're trying to course interrupt that.
So when we talk about momentum in our remaining minutes here, it's easy to track a bill through the State House and on the governor's desk. And one of the things I want to go back to what you mentioned in the beginning is how much more we're talking about this on this program, in other, you know, in other newspapers and television broadcasts. We're talking about it all the time. And this ongoing year-long process of looking at the infrastructure and services also helps, I hope, reduce that stigma of, you know, having to whisper about mental health. Do you have a sense, too, that people are getting more comfortable in the conversation, whereas maybe at one point everybody was a little awkward about, you know, how do we talk about this? Do I have to talk about this? To now there's a sense of, a reality and a comfort with the conversation that's useful.
Oh, I do think we've come a long way. And in my time in the legislature, this is my 8th year, I really see maturity and development in understanding the disease state of mental health issues, just as much as we've opened up the conversation about addiction. And whatever got you to that addiction, that's a whole nother conversation. But when you actually have an addiction, and what chemically happens in the brain and the changes to the addiction center is much more than about pathology and disease than it is about choice. So I think we continue to talk about it. It's important that we continue to open this up. It's important that we start to tackle these issues. And we have some very serious things that we need to continually keep our eye on, and not only talk about it, but actually do something. And so that's been an incredible privilege for me to be a part of meaningful work that is actually starting to change an infrastructure, work that we can see the outcome in the years to come and feel very satisfied that we did something about a very serious problem.
SDPB contributing writer Kevin Wooster's most recent blog is titled, Who is living in the governor's mansion and does it really matter? He joined Lori Walsh for a discussion. Let's take a listen.
Hey, Kevin, welcome.
Hey, it's great to be back.
All right, let's talk about some of the stories that you're looking at this week. And one of them is these sort of innuendos about where the governor lives. Tell us how this conversation really kicked off.
One of those reporter things, even old reporters. I'm minding my own business doing something else after the Black Hills Press Club, and I get kind of confronted by this woman who's not happy that reporters, the media, aren't reporting about the fact that Governor Kristi Noem doesn't live in the mansion, lives at the ranch, and that her daughter and son-in-law are full-time residents of the mansion, which this woman thinks is horrible and wrong. And of course, my first question is, well, is that true? And of course, that's the jumping off point for this blog piece.
Right. And there's anger in the question.
There is anger in the question. There's without actually knowing whether it's true or not, the woman was very upset by it. And you know, we see a lot of that anger before knowledge, anger before fact, anger before understanding, and sometimes afterwards too. So my first, she was unhappy that my first response was, what are you talking about?
Right.
And my second response was, I don't know if that's true or not, but if it is true, is that wrong? And she didn't like that very well because, you know, my question was governor's residence for the governor family. And even if the daughter and son-in-law were living there, they're part of the family, I guess, especially if it's a short-term arrangement or something. But I did say, as I said in the piece, that skepticism about fact or stories or alleged fact, I should say, or stories is a reporter's stock in trade, and but also should be inquisitive. And so I told her I would call around a little bit and find out if there was any truth to it.
Right. And before we get there, I also want to point out that part of the frustration or the anger that she's expressing is against the media for not covering it. So there usually has a pattern. I'm upset about somebody hiding something. And by the way, why aren't you reporting on it? And therefore, there must be some kind of conspiracy.
Yeah.
And paired with a lack of critical thinking about what the, you know, what the questions that we should ask during, you know, during that conversation even are. So all of it comes together. And this is kind of the world that we live in right now.
It is. And, you know, and I point out, well, if any of this is true and it hasn't been covered, remember, there's about 10 or 20% of the reporters working in South Dakota that would have been working in South Dakota at a peak, 30%. I don't know what the number is, way down. So everybody's trying to make decisions on what to cover. But I did check around a little bit and found out from sources that I trust, back-checked it with the governor's office, too, that the Cassidy doesn't live there. She and her husband don't live there. They've got a place of their own.
Cassidy is one of the governor's daughters.
Cassidy's one of the governor's daughters, the older daughter, married daughters. Her husband, Kyle, works for the Office of Economic Development. They're in Pierre, and they have a place. And Kristi is in the, I mean, it makes sense that Kristi, if you see her in the Capitol every day, she's probably not driving home to Castlewood that night, that during the legislature, for sure, she's there during the week, staying in the mansion or the residence, as you choose to call it. And is home a lot on weekends, which is what she did when she was in Congress. And she's got a son that's a senior, a husband that still lives there. I don't know what they're going to do when Booker graduates, you know, and moves off. Will Brian, her husband, move out to Pierre? I don't know. But basically, the woman had the facts wrong, although you can argue that maybe Kristi should be there or maybe she. And that's part of the discussion I raised was should it be like it was in the old days when basically people that were elected governor transplanted their families to Pierre and took up residence in the governor's mansion?
Or D.C. back in the
or
day.
Or D.C., same thing, same thing. Yeah. And I like both of those, but as I say in the piece, I also like manual royal typewriters too. So,
So I'm wondering, Kevin, if when Governor Noem was a Congresswoman Noem, one of the things she was criticized for in the press and around coffee shops was not being present for votes, and that was something that she had to overcome during the election for governor. Would she be present? And now people are saying, I don't think she's present. So is this part of her, you know, kind of overall reputation, fair or not, that is sort of staying with her, that it's just hard to shake loose from?
Yeah, both. I mean, she missed some votes in Congress, and I think most of the time, if you go back and look at congressional records, if you want to be picky, you can usually find some votes people probably should have been there for. And I can't believe on the congressional thing how they can fly out Monday, fly back Thursday or Friday, run around all weekend in airplanes, going to different places, and then do it all again. I can't believe that's good for your performance in Congress, but they do it all the time. And it's Herculean to me. I don't know how they pull it off. So they manage to manage their family here, and they manage their job out there. And that's what she's doing now or trying to do. But overall, as I say in the piece, I don't think you can ever accuse Kristi Noem of not showing up for work. She may miss some votes you think she should make, but she's a pretty hard worker. Yeah. And so I guess
she gets up pretty early.
Gets up pretty early and makes it to a lot of places. I mean, she gets around a lot, and she shows up in the legislature, and she shows up out here and over there. And
where does Kennedy live? Because that maybe is the daughter that is in question, because Kennedy is the one who got a raise. And I personally have heard some things that, Kevin, I'm going to say are straight up sexist when people accuse Kennedy. And it's, I don't want to repeat the things that people have said, but I will say, you know, it's sexist when you're not talking about her qualifications or how much she gets paid. You're talking about what she looks like, what she wears, and what she might look like in a swimsuit. So let's just say that those are the things that I heard recently, which are just nasty and untrue and really misogynistic.
Yeah, that's sad.
So where does Kennedy live?
I don't know. I don't care. I mean, she's a single daughter with a job in Pierre, and if she lives in the mansion, who cares? I mean, she's part of the family, but it's none of my business. Somebody asked me specifically, if a son-in-law and a daughter are full-time residents there, I guess that's a family there, and maybe you have that discussion. I'm not sure. If a single child is living in her mother's residence, which is the governor's residence, who cares? Mm-hmm. And I don't know Kennedy very well. She seems like a smart young woman. Everything I've known about her from interviewing her and talking to her, she seems very nice. I was critical of the raise she got only because I don't think it looks politically appropriate. And it had nothing to do with her gender. It's just a kid of the governor working in the office got a raise that stands out. I imagine Kristi Noem gave her a raise because she thought she deserved it.
And because her duties changed, and she was given increased duty. Now Tony Van Huysen is coming on board. Those duties continue to shift. So
that guy, he's back.
I do just feel like it's important every once in a while with our first female governor to point out when some of these, you know, some of the things people say, people ought to reflect a little bit on why they're saying them and how they're saying them and if what they're saying today is different than what they would have said about Tony Van Huysen being the governor's son-in-law or about what Kennedy Noem is doing. Just take a moment to think about what you're saying and make sure that you're going at it for the right reasons is my advice.
That is very important. I had an extended conversation with a Noem staffer by phone this week who I don't know well. And I brought that up because I said, I always have to back up a little and ask, is this criticism of Kristi Noem in any way based on gender? Mm-hmm. Because I think I've seen instances where it was. And I think you always have to be careful. She's a tough cookie, you know? And would we say that about it if she was a guy? Would we notice that about her, that in a campaign she is, as she says, ready to play full contact politics? I don't know. I have to watch myself on that, and I hope other people do too.
Yeah. Once again, skepticism and fact-checking and just going back and saying, are we being fair? Are we being equitable? It's a good question to ask. I want to quick, before we run out of time and we only have about 2 minutes left, talk about this Senate Concurrent Resolution 603, because you're going to write about that next week. And I printed out the original version of this resolution and the resolution as it currently stands. Yeah. There is nothing the same about
Not
them
much.
Except the number, really. Yeah. A couple words. What the heck happened here? At least Urbinger reported on it, and you can find it on our website, sdpb.org. But explain to people how in the world we can go from one thing to another in a concurrent resolution so quickly.
Well, you can hoghouse stuff, you know, and that's the term. And you can, if you got the votes, you can do just about anything in the legislature. And so we've got a resolution that talked about firearms-related deaths and firearms-related safety, and it was crafted very carefully by Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America and Reynold Nessebaugh, the senator from down your way, and to respect the Second Amendment, to outline some of the dangers of having guns in the home, and to promote the idea of gun safety and security to prevent maybe a quick decision, suicide, maybe an accidental shooting, and just, to me, common sense stuff as a gun owner.
And a resolution for June 5th to be Gun Safety Awareness Day.
Yeah.
Is where it started, yeah.
It started out, they were talking about Gun Violence Awareness Day, and or firearms violence, and that was too strong, so they changed it to Gun Safety Awareness Day, and then they changed it to Gun Safety Awareness, because they're trying to make it palatable in this NRA strong state. And it basically got rewritten to be a laudatory piece about gun safety courses and programs and teachers by the NRA and how much good they've done over the last 117 years.
Right.
Now, the end result is still
still pending.
A comment that says gun safety and security is important, and I think that's good. But I think taking out all that other stuff, talking about the real threats of firearms in the home, which are legitimate, that's why I'm doing a better job of securing my guns. I think that was unfortunate.
Sports gambling in Deadwood goes to South Dakota voters in November, and a new chief of staff for Governor Kristi Noem. These were the topics covered in this week's Dakota Political Junkies. Enjoy.
Joining us today, John Hunter. He's publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. Thanks.
Also with us, former South Dakota State Senator Tom Dempster, who represented District 9 for four terms. Tom, welcome back as well.
Lori, good afternoon. Good to be here.
Let's start with Tony Van Huysen and Governor Kristi Noem's third chief of staff, John Hunter. For those who don't know much about Tony, what's the significance of this selection, do you think?
Well, he's a very capable chief of staff. He's served in that position for Governor Dugard. And full disclosure, he is Governor Dugard's son-in-law. My experience with him, which actually dates back way back to a search committee when he was a student, when Dakota State was searching for a new president, that he was a student representative on that, and I was a community representative. So I've known Tony a long time, and our dealings with him as chief of staff when he was that position for Governor Dugard was very positive. He was on the transition team for a couple of different, I think maybe even three, when Governor Rounds first was elected, Governor Dugard, and then Governor Noem. So he's well familiar with the office and so on. So hopefully he will add some stability to that position, and I think he's a very capable administrator.
Tom Dempster, thoughts about what it means for the administration that this is the third chief of staff. Talk a little bit about that stability and the need for it.
Well, Lori, I would agree with John's assessment. I, too, have known Tony for quite a long time. What you get with Tony is you get someone who is discreet. You get someone who is loyal to a fault. He's very bright. When he was a student, he was on the board. He was a student representative on the Board of Regents, so he's been around a long time. He's a lawyer. He's the kind of guy that knows all, sees all, if you will. I watched him. It was interesting. In the state capitol, when Governor Dugard was in the rotunda, of course, he's surrounded by fives and tens and twenties of people that are surrounding him. And here was, yes, his son-in-law, but I think his chief of staff at the time, that stood about 10 or 15 feet apart from all of that melee, if you will, and just watched. And like I say, he's someone that you can trust. He's someone that I do think knows all and sees all. He's just who you would want for our chief of staff.
People have talked about, you know, who she has surrounded herself with and some of the policies. You know, is John Hunter, is her inner circle in need of some stability? Is she in need of Tony for a particular reason other than he's just a great candidate?
That's a really insightful question. I think there is some let's call it kind of bringing together that Tony can bring to that. You know, with people maybe with wanting to go in different directions. Of course, remembering that the cabinet folks report to the governor that as Tom was describing, that he is loyal to the governor in her policies and will be in the future. But I do think he can act as a very capable in-between person, and that's kind of what that job, I mean, we call it chief of staff as if he would supervise the staff, but it's really, there's a lot of, and Tom can amplify that, that's a bit of a legislative liaison, sometimes a public relations official, sometimes working with other states and so on. So there's a lot to it. One additional characteristic I think it's valuable to know here is that Tony responds quickly. Yeah. So if a person wouldn't try to get a hold of him, he would get a response back in a very short period of time, which is not true of all government officials, and certainly it's almost impossible to do for a governor. So I think that earns him some credibility among the people he works with.
Yeah, responsive. Definitely in the press, he's been responsive, whereas with this administration, we have not had the same response
right.
we had with the Dugard's administration. I don't know if that's been
very
the case
so.
For you, John Hunter, or not. But
yeah, I know you've seen that, Lori, too. I know you've, that's the kind of thing that all people in media and journalists go into is that you'd appreciate response, and he has done that, and that sets him apart.
Let's talk about, as we are getting ready to close the session, there are really only, I think next Monday is the date when all bills and resolutions have to have cleared their second house. And one of the things that's still alive is this idea of banning collective bargaining university faculty. John Hunter, start us out a little bit with why this is such a significant battle, because a lot of people are standing in opposition to it, and yet it is also really moving forward pretty solidly.
Yeah, I wish I had some more insight as to really the reasons for this legislation. It seems, and again, I'm an outside observer, right? I'm not a member of the higher educational system, and I'm not part of the legislature. I'm just an outside observer, but it looks like it's you're trying to fix something that doesn't need fixing. And so the idea in South Dakota is kind of collective bargaining. They talk about a union and so forth. It isn't that in the traditional sense like the United Auto Workers, where they're going to go out on strike or they're going to hold out for pay. That pay is largely set by several factors, but the legislature has to appropriate the money and the administration and the Board of Regents have input and policies and so forth. And so it's not in that kind of traditional sense of collective bargaining. There are a few states that require that faculty do not join a union. I don't know, a dozen or something like that. So, but it doesn't seem like it's been a big problem in South Dakota that we have this union, or as you'd call it, or somehow collection of faculty. So I can see why, if it doesn't seem to be a huge problem, why it's getting eliminated. But maybe Tom has some more insight into that.
Tom, do you think it's part of a broader conversation about the role of universities in the state, from money to political ideology?
Lori, that's a great question. And one of the things that I was really surprised at when I first came to the legislature was people seem, legislators seem to love to kick the Board of Regents. It's a huge amount of money, 10, 11, 12, 13% of the budget. Other than a budgetary process and appropriation, it's largely immune from legislative input. You can have a lot of thoughts, you can have a lot of conversations, but it's just kind of hard to get to them, if you will. And I think oftentimes you see that frustration in legislators' attempts to talk about the regions. So I think that for sure. Obviously, I think that has some fairly damaging results. Our regents will tell you that state funding to the universities is insufficient by and large. I think that that's true. Likely those are some consequences of that.
Let's switch gears a little bit and head to Deadwood for sports betting. And that ends up as a ballot question to amend the state constitution to allow sports betting. And, John, this goes back to, wasn't Marty Jackley talking about this, you know, some years ago, and just how the Supreme Court had sort of changed the landscape and voters sooner or later would have an opportunity to decide.
Right, here we are. There have been a number of states that have done that already. You know, New Jersey kind of led the charge with that. And so, yeah, South Dakotans will have an opportunity, to, as if they didn't have enough on this year's ballot already, to decide.
But good for voter turnout, right?
Yeah. let's get everyone excited. So, I'm curious to see how the campaign will go for both sides. You know, there are some people who are gambling opponents that don't like to see expanded gambling, especially in an area that at least a century ago was thought sports and gambling shouldn't mix, and now it's kind of getting there. I'm curious to see how that campaign is going to go for both sides.
This year, South Dakota's riot-boosting bill was introduced early in the session, unlike last year. And by all appearances, House Bill 1117 has completed the last leg of its journey to the governor's desk. The state Senate voted overwhelmingly Thursday to pass it. But earlier in the day, a Senate committee passed riot-boosting Part 2, starting that bill on a new journey. Now the legislature will have to consider that new bill in both houses by the end of the day, Monday, which is the last day for bills to pass both chambers. SDPB's Victoria Wicks reports on this development.
Senator Lee Schoenbeck brought the new bill before the Senate Commerce and Energy Committee on Thursday morning. He introduced it as an amendment to House Bill 1199, whose title indicated it had to do with electric utilities in an annexed area. The committee agreed to move discussion to the bottom of the agenda. When HB 1199 came up, Schoenbeck stepped up to testify and noted the room had emptied.
Just about everybody left. Apparently this isn't as interesting.
Turns out House Bill 1199 had been gutted and now contains an amendment to the riot-boosting bill. Schoenbeck notes the new bill cleans up problems with language.
It does away with the phrase riot-boosting, which was a locally created phrase that doesn't have a history in the law, and instead it talks about incitement to riot.
He says the second part now establishes civil penalties for incitement rather than boosting. Senator Jeff Monroe is disappointed with the process, saying the replacement bill should be somewhat germane to what it's replacing, and Schoenbeck responds.
I don't see any way that this compares with electrical companies. Can you explain that?
It's an energy policy bill, like the other one was. How's that?
House Bill 1199 passed the committee by a vote of 5-1 and has to clear both chambers by the end of day Monday. The initial bill, House Bill 1117, passed the Senate on a vote of 27-8 and heads to the governor's desk. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Victoria Wicks.
Well, that is the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or follow the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send us an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwepke, Chris Lawfrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.